Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
And a good Monday morning to you, and welcome into Darren, Donick, and Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. We are continuing to practice social distancing. I'm representing the South Side here in Rutherford County. Darren McFarland, that's me. Willie Donick over on the East Side in East Nashville. Chase McCabe out on the West Side out in Bellevue.
West Elijah. Side?
We'll do what?
I said West Side.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't hear what. Wasn't sure what that was, Chase.
Coming in hot on a Monday.
Yeah, coming in hot right out of the gates. Elijah Campbell holding the fort down there at 1824 Murfreesboro Pike at our Hosel Inc. Game Studios, powered by Rumble On. Guys, how's everybody doing?
I'm wonderful.
I think Willie is having to reconnect.
Ah, okay, so we don't have him yet. No, I'm doing well. Doing well. You know, I watched a lot of old sports this weekend, and that was kind of fun because, you know, for you guys, you remember the 1982 National Championship. I do not. I was not even a thought yet. So it was fun for me. And my dad, I was on the phone with my dad, and he was like, yeah, I remember this game. So that was cool. So it was a lot of fun to watch that. And then, you know, I got interrupted at the end with an update, but
yeah,
then I watched some of the 83 championship. And yesterday I watched 1986 race from Richmond, in which Dale Earnhardt and Darrell Waltrip wrecked coming to the checkers, and Kyle Petty got his first win. So that was cool. So I've had fun watching things that happened before I was born.
Tell everybody what NASCAR has been doing. What were they doing this weekend for a lot of people maybe who haven't seen and, you know, maybe want to check it out moving forward?
So this was really neat. So Denny Hamlin was a big part of this, and other drivers too, Dale Jr. They, for years, have all raced against each other on this platform called iRacing, and anybody can do it. You can go and get a subscription and build a car and go and race on a computer is essentially what it is. It's a video game. And so NASCAR has an iRacing series, and they've had it for the last several years as esports continues to take off. Well, since they couldn't race this weekend, a bunch of the drivers got together and said, you know what, let's get on iRacing. And let's go to Homestead, which is where we're supposed to be, and let's race, and let's have some fun. And so Fox Sports goes, you know what? That's a good idea. We'll televise it. We'll get involved. We'll put it on FS1. And so they had Mike Joy, Larry McReynolds, and Jeff Gordon as their broadcast team. And they had, like, Skype with some of the drivers so they could talk to them during the race. And they all got their rigs together, and they went racing for 100 laps at Homestead. And I ended up watching the whole thing, and it was actually really – it was pretty fun. It's very realistic. Denny Hamlin won the race. He beat Dale Jr., got him loose at the line and ended up winning the race. But you had Jimmy Johnson and Clint Boyer. Clint Boyer was the in-race reporter, and I spent most yesterday trying to get him on the show because it was hilarious of listening to him be the in-race reporter and try and drive at the same time. You had some drivers that had no idea what they were doing. Jimmy Johnson was one of those. And then you had some that, you know, you could tell that they've been doing it for a while. Dale Jr. has been doing this for 20 years. I remember 60 Minutes, Mike Wallace did a story on him doing, you know, this iRacing stuff. And so it was neat. And I think they're going to keep doing it until NASCAR comes back for real. But it was a lot of fun. And kudos to Fox and FS1 for being able to put it on and broadcast it because it was neat.
What is Clint Boyer doing? I mean, how could he possibly be busy today?
I don't know.
Hang with us, you know?
I don't know. I don't know. He's probably chasing his son around. He's probably chasing his son Cash around. So that's
that's probably put that on hold for 15 minutes.
I know.
We always enjoy our conversations with him.
I'm trying to get somebody from that crew on because it was neat. The trash talking's hilarious. Like Clint was doing a report and he goes, "Yeah, you know, I'm behind Dale Jr. and Dale Jr. is getting in somebody's rear end about something. He's mad. He's mad about something." So it was fun. So, you know, it's creative, it's outside the box, and it's entertaining while we sit here and have nothing to do.
Yeah. I think we've got Willie on with us. Willie, you there?
What's up, guys?
There we go. It's coming in loud and clear. Coming in hot. I actually checked out a lot of the because Saturday and Sunday, we couldn't take it. We had just had to get out a little bit. especially yesterday because it was so nice. So on the drive, just we checked out a lot, and actually I checked out more than just in the car. Listened to a lot of the Predators broadcast on 102.5 The Game this weekend. Of course, Saturday from 1 until 7 was four games against the Blackhawks in 2017, first-round action. Of course, they only needed four games to dispatch of Chicago. And then yesterday, listening to the Western Conference Final, that was interesting to hear that again and hear the Predators. I think we had games 1, 3, 5, and 6 yesterday, and it's hard to believe. Just think about, I know they had a lot of injuries and a lot of things happened throughout the course of that run to the Stanley Cup final, but Pontus Aberg was on their second line in that series in the Western Conference
Final. That was crazy.
Pontus Aberg was on their second line. Just soak that up for just a minute.
Well, he had hardly played at all during the regular season, and then he was in the opening day lineup against the Blackhawks because of his speed, as they went with more of a quick lineup. And then for the next series against the Blues, if you remember, they went with a bigger lineup that included guys like Cody McLeod. And then as the injuries piled up, they really had no choice but to play those guys. That's all they had left. Because remember, late in that series, they had that's when Freddie Gaudreau appeared for the first time, right? And he would start to play a bigger role. But when they lost Ryan Johansson and Mike Fisher after game four, game in overtime that the Ducks won to tie the series at two, that's when they were really down to scraps. And that's when you were wondering, is there any way they could find a way to win two out of the next three? And lo and behold, they won two in a row with that group.
Hard to believe. The fourth line was Vern Fiddler centering the fourth line with Austin Watson and Cody McLeod. In the Western Conference Final, Pontus Aberg on the second line. And they got to the Stanley Cup Final. Whew.
I think that's what was so cool about that run and that team, though, is you had literally everybody. It was that next man up mentality, and you had everybody stepping up and doing their part, and it worked. You know, outside of just being a couple wins short of the Stanley Cup, but even going into Game Six, I think we all of the Stanley Cup Final, everybody was like, they got a chance, they have a fighting chance, and to force Game Seven and see what happens. But that was what was fun about that series against Anaheim. I remember sitting in a bar going into Game Five, I guess it was, and you know, the injuries had mounted up and you're not feeling good, and they figure out how to get it done and then close it out the next game. But it was fun to hear some of those names again because I listened for a little bit as well.
Yep,
it reminds you how much rosters turn over, right? That was only 3 years ago, and there's plenty of familiar names and some that would have been playing that were hurt, like Ryan Johansson. But it still shows you how much teams change in the salary cap era, even though I think we would all say that the Predators have been relatively stable, right? The whole thing of we want to keep that nucleus together. But if you're not in the nucleus, there is a lot of turnover, even in a three-year span.
Yep. No doubt about this. Second line, that second line that I was – referring to Mike Fisher. This is before he got injured in the series. Mike Fisher, Pontus Aberg on the right, Colin Wilson on the left. Wow.
Wow.
Was P.A. Parenteau in there?
No. This was game.
Oh, that's right. He was on that team.
Game
he?
One. He was not in there. I remember Aberg didn't appear. He didn't appear in the Anaheim series. I'm trying to remember when he started, because remember, as you said, because in Anaheim is when Ryan Johansson, remember, in the faceoff, was that after game one when
that was
Kessler,
might have been one or two,
was
yeah.
it yeah one or two the whole Kessler maybe it was two Kessler the whole you know stick to the groin and I don't know how anybody can root for this guy, and that's what started that whole thing with those guys, and you know, it would spill over, and obviously we would learn, you know, Johansson would eventually leave. As you mentioned, Willie, that was the crazy after game four. You know, he goes to the hospital and, you know, we're getting on a plane to go back to Anaheim for game five. And it's like, okay, where are some of these guys? You know, what the heck is going on? And, you know, remember the news broke while we were on the plane about Ryan Johansson being hospitalized overnight. But, yeah, I think Parenteau came in, what, a little bit later in the series, right?
Well, he was always on the team. It was just a matter of whether he his skill set was needed or the depth got down to him. But that's why teams load up on depth at the trading deadline or are preparing themselves for, you know, what happens if we have to go to this guy or this guy? You know, who's our seventh defenseman? Who's our eighth defenseman? It all ends up coming back around, it seems like, especially if you go on a long playoff run. But there's definitely some attrition. That certainly happened in 2017. You wonder, Ryan Johansson was playing as well as he had ever played before he got hurt there. You know, it's a what if. They did an unbelievable job to win the two games to get to the final. And, of course, the finals against the Penguins, as we know, tied 2-2 after four games. But, you know, if they hadn't lost Johansson, what would that have been enough maybe to pull it off or get it an extra game to game seven? Who knows? I mean, this is the time, right? We're all reflecting about things we're watching from the past, and it kind of brings up so many what ifs.
When Mike Fisher and Johansson were down by the time game five, we were back at the Honda Center for game five. So there was a lot of shuffling because those guys were out. And I remember Aberg, when I was sitting there talking about him being on the second line, at that point, he had now been pushed to the first line. As you mentioned, Freddie Gaudreau, he's in the lineup. He's now centering the second line. And you've got Austin Watson, because the way he had been playing, being the injuries, been pushed up to that second line. So the second line in Game 5 of the Western Conference Final was Freddie Gaudreau, Colin Wilson, and Austin Watson. Pontus Aberg was on the first line with Colton Sissons and Philip Forsberg in the Western Conference Final in Game 5.
Was that the same series, too? Because I know you were talking about injuries, and Craig Smith was a part of it, that he came back, but then he wasn't quite ready, and he was kind of in and out. Am I thinking of the right series?
Yeah, no, I don't know that he ever really got back.
I don't think he played.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because I remember when they clinched, when they won the West, standing in the locker room, and he was in a suit. And I just remember having that conversation with him of, you know, that he wished he could be out there, and he just wasn't quite there.
Craig Smith didn't play.
He got hurt in one of the first games. It might have been game three of the first series, something like that. And it took him a long time. He might have tried to play in the finals, if I remember correctly, but he never did.
If I
remember correctly, it was a high ankle sprain. It just took a long time. Remember, everybody kept asking, is Craig Smith coming back? Mm-hmm. Are we ever going to get him back? Because they lost Fiala. Remember the catastrophic breaking of the leg? So he was gone. You knew there was no way he was coming back. Once Johansson had his thing, he was gone. No way he's coming back. Colin Wilson seemed to go in and out of some series, right?
He did. He did. He couldn't get right either.
He got hurt.
Well, learned James Neal was playing hurt.
He had a broken hand.
Broken hand or wrist, right?
Yeah. That he was playing through, yeah. And these are not uncommon in playoff runs, right, guys?
No
this
doubt.
Is what happens.
Yeah. We told you that CBS was going to be airing games over the weekend, and they had three games on Saturday, three games on Sunday. The first game to kick all this, you know, nostalgia of college basketball off was 1982's North Carolina versus Georgetown. And that was the first games that started at 11 in the morning on Saturday. So we thought we'd have a little fun with that and talk to Eddie Fogler, a guy we haven't talked to in a long time, former Vanderbilt and South Carolina head coach, Willie's coach at Vanderbilt. And it's been a while since we've talked to Coach Fogler. But, of course, he was on that staff in 82, and so we thought maybe we'd go down memory lane with him on the other side. So we'll talk to Eddie Fogler on the other side of Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Well, normally, back here on Darren Donick and Chase, Darren McFarland, that's me here representing the south side of town, Willie Donick over on the east side, Chase McCabe on the west side, and we would be sitting here on this Monday talking about all the crazy first-round action of the NCAA tournament and what took place. We would probably have already talked about Thursday and Friday, what took place over the weekend on Saturday and Sunday. Instead, CBS decided they've got all this available time. Let's air some old games. And kicking off the coverage on Saturday was Georgetown and North Carolina in 1982. And the man who was sitting on that bench helping with that Tar Heels team was their former point guard back in the day. And a good friend of the show, a guy we haven't talked to in a long time, Coach Eddie Fogler, is on the line with us, former Vanderbilt and South Carolina head coach. Eddie, how you doing? It's been a while since we've caught up with you. How are things in your neck of the woods?
Well, probably very similar to Nashville, Darren. Social distancing, staying in, hoping other people are doing that as well. And the thing I want to say quickly, certainly thinking about those people in Nashville who were affected by the tornadoes a couple of weeks ago, and also obviously everything with COVID-19.
Yeah, it's definitely been some strange times, especially in these parts.
Absolutely.
The last 2 or 3 weeks. Now that you've had time to social distance and reflect, and we can't do much, Coach, have you thought about Willie's shot selection back in the day? Do you feel like it got any better over time, or did you still today question some of the shots that Willie took?
Well, you know, the thing when it jumps out with Willie to me is not his shot selection. It was his assist-error ratio. He threw the ball all over the place. And I was more concerned with his judgment when having the ball in his hands. So, anyway, sorry about that, Willie.
I was hoping for a more glowing retrospective now that so much time has gone by. But, you know, that is a pretty accurate statement, I would have to say.
Willie tried hard. Now, Willie was competitive. He was good. He's a good player, very good athlete. Not many people could play two varsity sports, at the SEC level for sure.
So what was that like? We're sitting here watching, and I got to be honest, I loved just reflecting back. I mean, obviously we don't go back and watch these games. I remember these games that CBS was showing, but to go back and actually watch and just remember some of the finer details, you're like, oh, yeah, wow, I forgot about that play. Talk us through, you're there on the bench, you're a part of that whole run. What was that North Carolina team like to be around?
Well, you know, obviously a tremendous team, great talent, a star, a real star player in James Worthy, a future really good pro in Sam Perkins, two bigs that could really play. That game was a very, very high-level game with very, very high-level players. In New Orleans in the Dome back in 1982. So the crowd then was just, I mean, that was one of the biggest crowds that college basketball had. And, you know, the other thing, you know, it was a focus team. The last half of the season,
I believe we lost Coach Vogler. He got zapped.
Oh, no.
I wasn't sure if it was me or
Coach
Vogler.
That's what I was doing. I think we were all doing the same thing. I was like, uh-oh. I picked up my phone.
Yep.
I was going to text Elijah and go, uh-oh, I think I got zapped. So that was Coach.
Yep. I heard it clipping a little bit, and that's never a good sign.
So the three of us checked it out, right? We all were watching that game. Yeah. I mean, and he's
I was
right.
Watching, and of course the news coverage broke in the second half. So unfortunately, we didn't get to see the climactic finish, which was really the first time Michael Jordan became a household name. Right? Yeah. He was a great freshman player, but he was on a team that was completely stacked with all kinds of great players. You know, James Worthy was a junior. He was really the leader, and he had an amazing game in that game. But there were so many great players on that team that Michael Jordan was just one of them, and he hit the big shot, of course, at the end of the game.
Yeah.
So hopefully, and unfortunately, I don't think we got to see that. The news coverage went through, and then after that was over, the 83 title game, which was another thriller, was on after that. And then, of course, Darren, I don't know if you watched it, but the Kentucky-Duke game in 1992, one of the greatest games from start to finish, the regional final, Duke against Kentucky. That was a fantastic game. Great triple header, and then they had another one yesterday of some more recent games.
I was conveniently busy for the third
game.
Hey,
guys, I'm back
show.
On. I got cut off.
Okay. We've got Coach back. All right. Yeah, I'll let you.
And obviously Jordan, you know, was getting better and better as the year went on, particularly defensively. And then the unsung hero of that team was Jimmy Black. Jimmy Black was he was outstanding the last half of the year in running the team, directing the team. Great assist-error ratio, tremendous on-ball defender. So it was a tremendous team and a very dedicated team. The one negative was depth. The team didn't have a lot of depth, but we stayed out of foul trouble and stayed away from injuries for the most part.
What was Coach kind of the game plan? Because obviously that Georgetown team, I mean, the early 80s of Georgetown to the mid 80s, I mean, we know their roster was low. So what was – in fact, I was trying to remember on Saturday who was the actual favorite. I don't remember who was favored in that game. I don't know if you would know, but
I have no idea who was favored in that game, Darren. And you know what? I honestly can't remember the game plan. I do remember Worthy, and you know, it started off with Worthy just trying to go to the basket with those high-flying dunks and Ewing goaltending. And, I mean, there were statements being made very early in that game as to bring it on, so to speak, and everybody did bring it on. It was a heck of a game.
Yeah, because those guys, Ewing and Wingate, those guys were freshmen, weren't they? Were they freshmen or sophomore? They were very young.
Ewing was a freshman. He's the same year as Michael Jordan, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. And David Wingate, I'm not sure what year Wingate was at that time.
What about the finish? Because
those guys all came in the next year. Wingate and those guys came in the following year, all as freshmen. I think Wingate, Reggie Williams, some of the other guys that were on some of the future good teams. But Sleepy Floyd was on that team, was probably the next best player. But, Coach, you mentioned the goaltending by Ewing.
You're right, Willie. That's
right. I think
right.
That was
Wingate
something
was
that,
the next year. You're right.
But I think Patrick Ewing goaltended three or four times in the first 4 or 5 minutes.
Right.
In that game?
Yes. Yes, he did. By the way, Sleepy Floyd was from Gastonia, North Carolina, by chance.
Wow.
How about that? Yep, right out there. And Gastonia is right outside Charlotte. So he grew up in the state of North Carolina and wound up going to Georgetown.
Well, Coach, go ahead.
You know what dawned on me as I was watching some of those games, because they showed the 83 final right after the 82 final, and you guys had played those Houston teams in the Final Four in the past too, is you could really build a team, right? Even some of the best players like Olajuwon and Jordan and Patrick Ewing, they would at least play 3 years, if not the full four. So it's such a different game that we're watching back then with mature teams that had played together a lot as opposed to what you see today.
Oh, totally different. I mean, the one and done and, you know, is becoming, you know, more prevalent all the time, even for players who aren't ready for the NBA. And then secondly, I don't know how coaches build rosters now with the transfer rules that basically it's free agency and, you know, you can transfer and be eligible right away somewhere else. And it's crazy. I mean, I don't know. And you know, the mid-major coach who's developed kids has found, you know, kids who are, you know, were under the radar, has done a great job with them. And he's preparing for his next year. And all of a sudden, two of his kids decide to transfer out in April or May, and he hasn't prepared for replacing them. It's really difficult, I think. And, well, from my perspective, I'm very anti being able to transfer and be eligible right away.
Coach, a lot of people, I think, may have watched that game and they were very familiar with Michael Jordan's career, maybe didn't trace it all the way back to then. But what were your thoughts? What can you recall about the recruitment process of Michael Jordan? I remember growing up, a lot of coaches – at the various basketball camps would use him as a teaching tool and say, hey, here's a guy that when he was in ninth grade, I think was cut from his high school team. He didn't make the varsity early. It's not like he was always great, but take us back to that time and how you guys tracked him.
Okay, Willie. That what you just said is true. Michael was basically cut from his high school JV team when he was a ninth grader. Michael, from Wilmington, and there was a North Carolina graduate who ran the recreation centers in Wilmington, Mike Brown, and Mike Brown had called our offices when Michael was a junior in high school. He played JV as a sophomore, and he was a starter on the varsity as a junior, but wasn't, you know, really known. And Mike Brown called us, and Coach Bill Guthridge went down toward the end of Michael's junior year and saw him play, and came back and thought, you know, he was a great athlete, but didn't know how good a player. And I said to him, let me go down, I'll take a look. He said, well, he's coming to our basketball camp in the summer, so let's evaluate him in the summer. Well, he came to camp in the summer, and, you know, it was pretty obvious to me and, you know, Coach Smith and Coach Guthridge that he had a chance to be something outstanding, maybe something special. And then, and nobody knew. you know, nobody knew. And then after he left our camp, he went to Five Star, which is, you know, was Howard Garfinkel back in the day. And that's where all the very good players, particularly in the eastern part of the United States, southern part of the United States, went to camp to play. In fact, Patrick Ewing was there the same week as Michael. And Michael went unknown to Five Star, and 1 week later was ranked top five in the country. He went from being unknown to, you know, being top five in a week. And then the recruiting blew up, obviously, and, you know, we were very fortunate that he wanted to stay close to home. And, you know, great family, and the Jordans never missed a game while he was there.
When did you guys realize as a staff that the competitive edge, that's the one thing that always seems to separate him? Not only was he an incredible talent, as we all know, but that competitive fire that people always talk about. When did you guys first get a sense of that?
You know, that was early, Willie. You could see the competitiveness early. You know, he always, particularly in drills, any competitive drill, you know, you could see the competition that he would thrive on it. You could also see that when he didn't win a drill or his team didn't win, his group didn't win a drill, you know, competitive drill. Coach Smith always kept drills competitive. There was winners and losers of every drill at every practice. You might remember that when you played, Willie, and then at the end of practice, the winners watch the losers run for the drill, the competition of the drill. So if you won a drill, you didn't have to run sprints or a sprint, the losers would run, and you could see the disappointment. So we knew that pretty early. What I didn't realize was early on, or even watching him in high school, was how unbelievably instinctive he was in terms of, you know, knowing, you know, he was a pass or two ahead of everybody else. He had the natural born instinct to have tremendous savvy and feel for the game and what the opponent player was thinking, and he could read it and see it. And then with Coach Smith taught him how to understand it. So he did it instinctively, and then Coach Smith was able to teach him, you know, why and how. And so it just took it to another level. But that was the real surprise to me.
One more question for me, and I think Chase will have a question or two for you. But I want to ask you, I know recently I got a chance to see you and the guys from the 1993 SEC championship team. And, of course, people may have watched the Duke-Kentucky game from the year before, 1992, with Jamal Mashburn. He was there at Kentucky in 93. You guys were able to beat them out for the championship. But you got a chance to see a lot of the guys who you hadn't seen in a long time. It was great to get those guys together. But maybe give us a thought or two about that team, because I know that team is increasingly special, I think, to the Vanderbilt fans as they look back on it.
Yeah, you know, first of all, let me say this. It was an absolute blast for me to be back and see everybody on that team, you know, except for Billy, who unfortunately couldn't be there, Billy McCaffrey. So I'm going to digress here a minute, Willie, if I might. So it was just a real high for me to see all the players, but honestly, almost maybe even more, certainly just as much, to see their wives. And the real kick for me was to see the children. Oh, my gosh, is it fun to go up to former players, you know, children, and go, I know your dad when he was a pain in the butt, so to speak, and just kid with them and get to know them a little bit. That was fabulous. We had every player come back. I think almost every spouse came back, and I think almost everybody brought their kids. So it really was special, I think, from that perspective for everybody, and it certainly was for me. While we were at the reception after the Florida game, you know, up in Memorial, while we were having our reception, there was, you know, clips of the team. The Kentucky game, I think, was on one time. And so I was able to sit there, stand there actually, and watch the team play a little bit back in the day. And the thing that stands out to me was overall was I think it was an extremely smart, very savvy basketball team. Everybody understood the game. Everybody was a good passer. Everybody was competitive. You know, I used to write on the board all the time, Willie, I think you'll remember, play hard. The team played very hard, play smart. It was a very intelligent team, and play unselfishly. And it was a very unselfish team. that had very good players. I don't think we had great players, but we had the three things that I just mentioned, and a player in McCaffrey that could go get a basket. We had those attributes, and those components make up really good teams.
We're talking to Coach Eddie Fogler, longtime Vanderbilt, South Carolina head coach, and was an assistant at Carolina during that 82 championship game. And, Coach, I was telling these guys earlier that obviously that game I was not around yet, so it was really cool for me to kind of share that moment with my dad because he remembered it and watch it. But, you know, the things that stood out to me, there wasn't a shot clock, there wasn't a three-point line, and those are things that I have always known with the game of basketball, so I had never really gotten to experience a game without that. As you sit there as a coach and you see those times before the three-point line, before the shot clock, you know, how have things evolved with this game, and do you think that there are elements from that era that could be adopted today to make it even better?
You know, I don't know if Willie, were you there when Kevin Anglin, we were talking at breakfast,
yeah,
on Saturday morning that Kevin Anglin.
Oh yeah, great conversation, I thought.
Yeah, you know, Kevin was an incredibly smart, competitive player and an outstanding coach right now at NBA, was, you know, could argue the fact that the shot clock has slowed the game down. Remember that, Willie? And he was,
yeah.
Was he not arguing that, you know, without a shot clock, people would play more openly and not take as many bad shots, and the percentages would go up? We were a high-scoring team. I don't have the data in front of me, but I believe we averaged over 80 points a game that year, Willie. Would that be correct?
That is correct. Over 80 points a game, and this was a 45-second shot clock. And I think the other thing we discussed, Coach, was, too, the mixing of defenses, the changing of the styles that teams would play with when they did either no shot clock or a 45-second shot clock. There was more variety.
Yes, much more variety. And therefore, the scoring was higher. People weren't forced to take bad shots or play, you know, weren't as afraid to make a mistake back then as you are today. The game today to me is basically somewhat boring. I mean, how many teams press today? Not many. How many teams use multiple defenses? Not many. How many teams trap a ball screen? Not many. The game to me, how many teams play zone a lot? Not many. And so, you know, the three-point shot, the shot clock, to me, has made it an all man-to-man game, half-court man-to-man. Everybody's trying to guard ball screens or dribble handoffs, and seems to me everybody's playing alike. You know, if I came back into coaching, I still would be changing up a lot. I would be different. And so when you had to prepare for, I think, a team that I coached, I would like to think it would be much more difficult because we were going to be different than everybody else. So I watch a lot of hoops, and it all looks the same for the most part.
Interesting. Last thing, Eddie, the very next game they showed was the NC State and Houston game the following year, and I know Houston had beaten Louisville to get to that national championship game, and NC State had beaten Georgia, who I think you guys had lost to in the Elite Eight.
Lost to Georgia and Birmingham, and Syracuse lost to Georgia, correct.
I don't remember, Coach, much about that Georgia. I know Vern Fleming, but there's not much that stood out. What was Vern Fleming, I think, was a junior or senior when you guys played him. What else did they have?
Oh, they had James Banks from Atlanta, who we recruited very hard at North Carolina. Vern Fleming, Terry Fair was a 6'7" athlete from Macon, Georgia. They weren't very big, but they were very quick, athletic, and Vern Fleming was a 6'5 point guard. He was very difficult to guard, and they played great, and the Tar Heels didn't play so great. And that was up in Syracuse, New York, at the Carrier Dome, if I'm not mistaken. So, they were very good. Why are you bringing up that brings back?
I'm sorry. I just
we're not ending on a high note.
No,
here.
I know. I didn't remember. I've forgotten that Georgia had been, you know, had gotten to that Final Four, and I was trying to remember what stood out to me about that Georgia team. You faced them, and I was just curious. I remember Vern Fleming.
Yep.
And that's really all.
Yeah, and Hugh Durham was the coach back.
Yeah,
that was back when you first, you know, had been at Georgia a long time. And. And he was getting the best players out of Georgia. He got Vern Fleming out of New York. Heck, Vern Fleming. We try to recruit Vern Fleming at North Carolina. Vern Fleming went to a high school literally 15 minutes from where I went to high school. And boy, did I waste a lot of time.
You tried to use angles, didn't you?
We never had a chance. And I spent over a year up there recruiting them and knew everybody that knew them and grew up 10, 15 minutes away. And at the end of the day, he was going to be a Georgia Bulldog. Read of the situation is what that's called.
Well, hey, it's been a while since we caught up, and we really appreciate your time. You be safe, and
my pleasure.
We'd love to talk to you again down the road.
Well, thanks for having me. Let me say this before I go. I had a chance to see Vanderbilt play for a half here in Columbia when they played the Gamecocks. I was at the Florida game, February 1st, I believe, for the honoring of the 1993 team. I've watched, I don't know how many games on TV. And I want to give a shout-out to Coach Stackhouse and his staff. I thought the team, he was very well coached, played hard almost all year long, really did a good job. Jerry and his staff did, I really think, a very good job coaching this team and maxing out for the most part, what he had to work with. So kudos to Jerry Stackhouse and his staff and this year's Vanderbilt basketball team.
Yeah, good stuff. Eddie, thanks for the visit. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. See you guys.
That's Eddie Fogler, former Vanderbilt, South Carolina coach. He was on the bench as an assistant for that 82 North Carolina team that beat Georgetown. Good stuff from him, as always. We will come back. More of Darren Donick and Chase on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Back here on Darren Donick and Chase on this Monday morning. Hope everybody's having a good start to your week under these circumstances. Good stuff there from Eddie Fogler. We thought you would enjoy that if you were able to watch the game on Saturday, even if you weren't. Good insight right there. You're not going to get that anywhere else. Eddie knew those teams inside and out, and that was Willie's coach at Vanderbilt, and we thought it would be fun to catch up with him. Willie, it's been a long time since we've talked to Coach Fogler. Many years.
Right. People might remember we used to have him as a weekly guest on the show back during the times that maybe college basketball had a little bit more of the spotlight than it does now. But, two-time National Coach of the Year. He was with that 93 team we were talking about at Vanderbilt. And I was thinking about them a lot while I was watching that 92 Kentucky Leitner shot against Duke. We had played that Kentucky team three times. This was the year before. This was the
Darren,
year.
Did you watch that game? Did you watch it on Saturday?
No, I conveniently left.
I was wondering.
You'd had enough for the day, huh?
Because we had that discussion one time.
My son really enjoyed.
Would you go back and watch those?
My son really enjoyed watching pieces of all three. He didn't watch them all start to finish, but he watched a lot of it with me. And I think I was pleasantly surprised how much he was enjoying the game. So we had played that Kentucky team three times, and then the following year they lost that great senior core leadership, Feldhaus, Pelfrey, Farmer, and Woods, but they got more talented guys coming in. That 93 team, I think, had Tony Delk as a freshman. You know, we talked to him recently. Dale Brown was an underrated player that was just coming on the year before. You saw him play a big role in that, but that was such a great era. But Coach Fogler was the National Coach of the Year in 93. That 93 team, had they won one more game, they got beat by Temple, who had three NBA players on it, and nobody really knew how good they were at the time. But had they won that game, they would have played the Fab Five, another intersection of basketball history, in the 93 regional final. Who knows what would have happened in that game? I would have loved to have seen that game, because Fab Five is making the rounds, right? You 30
sure,
for 30s,
yeah.
You see those all the time.
Yep.
And then Coach Fogler was also the National Coach of the Year in 1997 with a South Carolina team that went 15-1 in the league, also ousting in the regular season a great Kentucky team that went all the way to the finals. That was Ron Mercer. That was Derek Anderson. Remember, Kentucky lost, I think, in the final to Arizona that year. Is that right?
Yes. You talking about a 97?
97, yeah.
They lost that Miles
was
Simon.
Was that Patino's
Bibby
last year?
Simon team, yep. Yeah,
that was Patino's
last year.
So I'm just
Tubby
so you just
came
think
in
about
and won
the
in 98, beat Utah in 98.
Right. So you're just thinking about the history that Coach Fogler is involved with. We're getting very historical, right? This is a great time for a history buff. It's not a great time in general, but this is a time where you have time to go back through the annals of history. You think about being involved in the recruitment of a Michael Jordan, and this was, you know, he played in the late 60s and the early 70s for Dean Smith, played in a Final Four, Coach Fogler did. And, of course, North Carolina was in it every year, it seemed like. Even years where way less than 64 teams made it. Some years it was 16, then it went to 24 for a while, then I think it was maybe in 32 for a while. And North Carolina always had great teams. So the amount of great players that he saw come and go, it's really something.
It is. You know, and look, I feel like if we can get through this, we can get through any sports time. Summers are going to feel like a walk in the park, right, once we get past
Well, we may have this. Sports in the summer. I mean, that's the thing.
I'm just saying in general, summer's going to be, right. Just a breeze summer months moving forward after going through this, whenever this ends, because, you know, last week we had the kiss of NFL news, but once, you know, basically all that stuff starts dying down, this is what you get. It's interesting you bring up, you know, kind of the history lesson, the nostalgia. That's what we're doing right now. We're kind of walking down memory lane. I was looking at someone that I graduated with in high school that I don't talk to anymore, but I'm friends with on Facebook, so I keep up with her that way. And she said, she posted this yesterday, said she was going through boxes in the attic and found two games from 1979 still in their original boxes, still working perfectly fine. And I want to see if you guys remember. Do you remember, let me start with Merlin. Do you remember that?
Willie, oh, yeah.
Merlin, the red? Isn't that totally. Where you had to, was that a memory game? What
I
was
think.
Merlin? Do you remember?
My cousins had that, and we used to play at their house, and I'm trying to remember. I feel like it was a memory game. Well, Simon was the memory game, right, with the red, the four lights, the four different colors.
Correct.
Where you had to mimic. They would add a note every time, and you had to go back through and get it right.
That's correct.
Merlin, I think, was a version. They had different games, though. Merlin had a more variety of games, if I remember correctly.
I saw it, and I remember having a Merlin, and back in the day, I was amazed that she said that, you know, they were in the original boxes, they worked just fine, and the other one was Wildfire and Merlin were the two that
Wait,
she
what
put.
Was Wildfire?
I don't remember Wildfire. I really
I remember
don't.
The name, but I don't remember the game.
I really don't. I don't remember Wildfire.
This is all very foreign to me.
I know this is.
Yeah, see, this
I
is
cannot
this
provide
way
any
over
help
really
here.
Different world for Elijah and Chase, but this used to be the stuff. Like if you had board games, were definitely a staple, right? The game of life, Monopoly, all of these things. You had those games, but then if you had a game that had batteries, oh man, now you were the cool person, and you had to get everybody over there. I mean, this was pre-video games, right? You didn't really have.
This is late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah. The video games were, if they were there at all, were very primitive. Most of them were in the arcade. Maybe you had Pong or something, you know, something really simple in your house. And then, of course, everything started to change over time when people started getting Atari, right, and games like that or whatever the version was. And then, of course, it all evolved from there. That's when games like Merlin and Simon – They started to be a little less popular, I would say, at that point.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the point is, Chase, in these times right now, you can appreciate, because this is as close as we'll ever get to back then. I mean, we still have our phones. We still have the internet. And so we're still nowhere near close to what it was like. But this is what you did. I mean, this was your form of entertainment. I mean, we didn't have any of that stuff. And so back then, as Willie said, I mean, games like this especially, this was gold, because
and they might be gold now for the next few weeks. I mean, throwback games like that sounds like fun.
Well, most things have come back and been successful, right? So why not stuff like that? So just thought I'd throw that out there. We'll come back, wrap up the first hour. We'll talk to Teron Davenport to kick off the second hour, find out what he thinks about what the Titans have done thus far. They've still got a lot of moves they haven't made, so we'll talk with TD to begin the second hour. Darren, Donick, and Chase, but we'll come back and wrap up things next on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Well, Eddie Fogler brought up the state of New York several times in that interview, and I don't know if you guys have seen this, but New York, now the new numbers for coronavirus cases is now over 20,000 in the state of New York. Over 20,000 in the state of New York. By the way, while we were in the break, too, I don't know if you guys saw this, Senator Amy Klobuchar, who says her husband has tested positive for coronavirus. So that just came out when we were in the break. So we continue to, watch the numbers soar. I think, what are we at in the state of Tennessee? Up over 500, approaching 600. I think the last check. I don't know if you guys have seen a new number.
I haven't seen a new number today. I know that, it's just, we know it's going up, right? Wherever you are. And you might be listening somewhere to this where it hasn't come to you yet, or maybe your numbers are low in your particular area, but this is what everybody's stressing. It's not like it's not going to get there eventually. The way it's spreading, this is why we have to control what we control and really be strict with our movement, right? The less we move, the less the virus moves. It's so easily transmitted, and sometimes you don't know for a week or 2 weeks that you've passed it along or you had it to begin with. That's the really stealth thing about this thing. It's so hard to know what's going on. But the numbers are going to keep going up. It doesn't know borders. It doesn't know counties, right? It's just moving at different rates at different times. But it's here, and so we have to do everything that we can. I noticed this, too. This is where you just mentioned New York. Darren, I know we talk a lot about the people on the front lines. I saw a report where a lot of the policemen, right, who are the ones trying to enforce, as well as they can, the curfews, the shelter at home, all of the ordinances that are out there, but they're the ones that end up getting infected, right? It's just like the medical workers who are the most at risk. The next people are those responders, right, that are trying to do the things to keep people separated. So you can't stress enough, the people, there's too many people still out there that aren't paying attention, right? Do these things, right? It's all we're asking you to do. We're not asking you to do a whole lot right now in the grand scheme of things. But, boy, my heart goes out to those policemen and the ones that are still out there doing what has to be done right now.
No doubt about it. And, well, you don't really have much of a choice here in these parts because it's finally come down to basically everything is shutting down. I mean, that's where the essentials,
you have takeout,
right?
That's it.
Yeah. It's really where we are. I told you we had to get out Saturday and Sunday just to get out a little bit. And Saturday, driving through the Avenue, Medical Center Parkway, 5:30, 6 o'clock on Saturday, is usually a hard place to navigate. Nobody. It was weird. Nobody had a car in sight.
I saw pictures of downtown. Did you see pictures of downtown
over the weekend? Nothing.
Broadway.
Yeah, Broadway. Nothing.
I saw Jim Wyatt put a picture out.
That's good.
On Twitter, and it was a ghost town.
That means
there
we're doing it right, right?
I will say this. I don't know if you guys saw this, but this is cool because I know some people in the service industry and musicians that play downtown. Some of the bars actually allowed bands to come in and set up, and they Instagrammed or Facebook Live their performances that they usually would have, and people were tipping remotely so they could make some sort of money. So I thought that was cool. I don't know how long they'll be able to actually do that, but I thought that was neat that they were able to do something and try and add a little normalcy and also make some money because that's their livelihood.
Yep. It's really cool. Look, everything you can. In fact, that's going to be part of my This Is What I Know coming up in about less than an hour, about 45 minutes or so. We'll do This Is What I Know, and that's part of mine. We will come back and talk with TD, Teron Davenport, to kick off the second hour, find out what he makes of the Titans' moves, and is there a big move to come? We'll do that to kick off the second hour of Darren, Donick, and Chase. That's next on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.